Good afternoon. I'm interviewing Dr. Bruce Ritchie, long-time family of Hastings, and he will have a very interesting story to tell, I'm sure. It's the 18th of May, and... Okay, Bruce, it's all over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Well, I was born in Hastings at Sister Cooper's, who was on the corner of St. Auburn Street and Market Street. I went to school. First of all, we used to live in a number of houses which were owned by my grandfather, and we'd shift around in Hastings. I first went to school at Parkvale, and my best friend was Gordon Black. And I can recall each day going back to the Black House in Avenue Road, opposite Vidal's, and we would have a glass of milk and a homemade biscuit. And we sat on the steps by the back door. The back doorstep was scrubbed every day. It was totally white, but we were not allowed to go inside because we might bring in some dirt. So we did this every day for 2 years, and then we shifted house down to Eastbourne Street, and this was a house behind my grandfather's business, Thomas Ritchie Limited. And so I changed schools and went to Central School. Those days were fun days. At about that time, there was the polio epidemic, and so school was stopped, and we used to get our lessons for school in the newspaper. But we used to play tennis on the Eastbourne Street Road. Things were very basic. I had two sisters, Jean and Betty. Going back a year or two, when I was just about 2 years old, because we had lived in this house before, my mother put me outside in the pram, and because it was sunny, she put the hood up, and then the earthquake struck, and the chimney came down, hit the cover of the pram, and I was protected from any major injury. So I went to school at Central until I left in Form 2. During this time, I used to work in my grandfather's shop. I was the gopher boy. I'd go for the mail, I'd go for the whatever. Then I used to do work in the holidays, and I assumed that this would be my career. My father was in the business, and so was my uncle. But in those days, the head person, in this case my grandfather, they were in total charge. So I did think that I would one day become the owner of the business. But then one day my father said to me, "I want you to become a doctor." And so I said, "Okay." And so that was good. Well, I still think I could have done very well in the business. So I went to Boys High for 5 years, and then I went to Victoria University. In those days, medical intermediate was very hard, and I was not able to do well during the terms. But with a bit of cunning, I suppose, I thought, well, I can't ever do all the work. So I looked at last year's exam paper, and I saw some questions. I went back for about 7 or 8 years, and I found that each year there were a lot of questions which were of the same sort. And so I thought, well, if I learn all those questions, I should be okay, because you had a choice of 5 out of 7 questions. So I did very well, got second in the university, and went down to Dunedin. And I had a very enjoyable time, but it was hard work. Hard work in the physical sense. We used to go out to Port Chalmers and work on the wharves, and we also had to work very hard with study. So I eventually qualified in 1953, and my first job was at the Hastings Hospital. In those days, Len Broughton was the superintendent. So I worked there for 3 years, and I said to Dr. Ballantyne, shall I start practice at Hastings? He says, no, go away for a year or two. So I went up north to Kaikohe in the Bay of Islands to do a locum for Dr. Paiwai. He was a Maori All Black. But I stayed for 9 years because I was so busy, I didn't have time to shift. But I would travel down sometimes to Hawke's Bay, to Hastings, which was about a 12-hour trip, come down for Easter weekend to see my parents. So we were in Kaikohe, we built a house, but people were very poor. They could not pay me in money. So I got tailrows, crayfish, whitebait, fish, meat, whatever. But because our fridge was not very big, I had to give most of it away. So we had 4 children, and I suddenly realised that I was actually starting to spend more than I could make. So I thought, this cannot go on for too long. So I decided to come back to Hastings, where the chance of making a reasonable living was far greater. But the people up in Kaikohe were mainly Maoris. They were loving people. You know, a clean Maori person was a very, very clean person. Their houses were immaculate. But however, a lot of Maori houses were not very clean. But I used to get calls from 4 in the morning till about midnight. The early morning calls were the people in the country. The late calls were people in the town. I can recall one morning, the phone going about 5 o'clock, and a voice said to me, that you, Doc? And I said, yes. He said, you come and see the old man, eh? I said, well, what's wrong with him? And he said in a very serious voice, he just woke up dead. And that's really what happened. He woke up every morning alive, but this morning he woke up dead. So we came back to Hastings, and I worked at the hospital for a year, and then went into private practice in Raurika, and started off with no clients. But I can recall the first day, a woman came in who was not sick, but she said, I've come to have a look at you. And I said, why? Well, she said, I want to see how young you are and how fit you look. I said, why? Well, she said, Norm Wimson had just died. She said, that Dr. Wimson, he's the second doctor who's gone and died on me. So we became friends. The hospital work was, I got involved in anaesthetics at the public hospital because there was no one to do them. So 7 general practitioners decided to form a team and supply all the anaesthetics day and night. And I also worked at Royston, which paid a bit better than public. But they were good days. We worked as a team, and we did not do it for money. It was done as a vocational position. I can recall the last day I did duty in hospital, I worked for 8 hours on Sunday in the theatre for acute cases. And my reward for that 8 hours on a Sunday was $50. We were paid according to, we did so many sessions, a session for your cold cases and a session for the acute cases. So it was not done for money. So the reason I left is because Stuart Drysdale and myself had decided to buy a bit of land out at Mangatahi, which became a deer farm, but we had no time to spare doing anaesthetics. So the deer farm was there, but the farm itself, the first year we had it, was a drought, and there was not one blade of grass on the farm. And I said to Stuart, we haven't chosen well. Although, first of all, we thought we might have grapes on the land. We had a river going through it. But we were told by the agricultural department that grapes would be pulled out soon, and that would be a waste of time. So after 10 years, I decided to, we had an offer for the farm, but we had a plan that after 10 years, if one person wanted money out for any reason, the other person had the right to purchase. So Stuart wanted some money for his family to go to university. So I bought the farm and I changed over to cattle breeding, which was much easier because there was a lot of work involved for our wives in the feeding out every day.
Can we just go back a little bit? Thomas Ritchie, what sort of business?
I'll go into that now. Thomas Ritchie Limited, he was my grandfather. In fact, I thought he was a king because one of the photographs I had was him dressed up as the Grand Master in the Masonic Lodge. And I said to my friends at school, well, my grandfather's a king. So there was my grandfather who had the business, which first of all was down the other end of town next to F.L. Bone. And then for some reason they shifted up to West Heratonga Street next to Roach's. And we had land going from Heratonga Street right through to Eastbourne Street, a big area of land. So there was a plumbing part to it and an electrical part. My father ran the plumbing department and my uncle ran the electrical part. In those days, this was during the war and just after, my grandfather employed about 40 men and we had 7 light vehicles, which was a major thing for a business. I can recall Jimmy O'Connor, the ex-mayor of Hastings, used to work as a plumber for my grandfather. And I can recall seeing him on his bicycle riding along with a toilet pan through his arm. That's how things were transported. So I worked school holidays. I used to work in the shop. I used to do the banking, get the mail, go for the morning tea. We had a couple of characters there. One was Jack Keown, who worked there all his life, and the other was Hilda Pope. Hilda Pope had red hair. She had it from the time I knew her. I don't know whether she's still alive. I used to look for opportunities, and I can recall, this is at the end of the war, you could not buy a torch anywhere, and I happened to be in Mackenzie's store and I saw some torches there, picked them up, and I saw made in Japan. I think it was Japan. And they were about 2 and 6 each, 2 shillings and sixpence. So I went back to the shop and said to my father, can I have £2 to buy some torches? He said, oh, sure, take it. So I went and bought the torches for £2, so I would have got 8. No, sorry, 16, yeah. And so I brought them back and put them under the counter, and I put one on the counter. I can recall the first chap coming in, a farmer, saying, is that torch, is that for sale? I said, yes. schools, could I buy it? I said, yes, they're 12 and sixpence. 12 shillings and sixpence, which I thought was pretty good profit, 500%. So he took it, where he went, I put another one out. So I sold the whole 16, whatever it was, in a very short time, at great profit to Thomas Ritchie Limited. Now I thought, because my grandfather had all the licenses for all the overseas equipment, like irons and toasters and what have you. So he was the master importer. So that was, it was pretty profitable. So my grandfather, we had a house at Halmoana. He had a two-story house there. And we had a batch or a small house behind. And my uncle had one along the road. And my grandfather was the first person in Hawke's Bay to have an upstairs toilet. It was never heard of before. So coming back to Hastings, my father and my uncle worked as a team, but beneath the umbrella. And they were simple days. I can recall I was the person who swept out the shop and washed the floors and did that sort of work. I can recall they used to have boxes of fittings of any sort, plumbing fittings or switches, whatever. And they had a system whereby we had a box, like a shelf, and on the front there was a card which said 20. And when you took out one thing from the box, you crossed out the 20 and put 19. And that's how they did their stock take. Quite simple.
While you're thinking, I've got a question here. You had two sisters. What were their names?
Betty, or Elizabeth, really. Betty eventually went to Canada on an OE, and she got married over there, so she lived in Vancouver for many years. She died suddenly at the age of 61, which my parents found very hard to accept, having a sibling go before them. And my other sister, Jean Ford, with an E on the end, she lives at Matapiro, on a 400-acre farm. And her husband was part of the Matapiro estate.
And were they older than you or younger?
Betty was a year and a half older, and Jean was about 2 years younger.
When you were in Kaikohe, you used to drive down here. What sort of car did you have?
I had a Valiant Charger. Two-door. I bought it from Thompson Motors in Caramba Road, and we packed the back seat with all our luggage and put a mattress on the top of this luggage, and the four children slept on the mattress. When I was up there, on a weekend on call, I'd do 200 miles visiting people. Because some people were 35 miles away one way. Today, no one visits anyone.
Actually, when you said that you called on them, thinking of that TV program about the doctor who used to do his rounds. It was an English program. He did all the calls out in the country.
Well, talking about that, I can recall my first day on duty in Kaikohe. We'd arrived with £80, that's all I had. And we had a house lined up to rent, and we'd bought a mattress to put on the floor. We couldn't afford bed ends. And our table to eat off was a packing case. We had that for 6 months as a table. I can recall Cyril Whittaker used to fly up there for aerial mapping. They used to come and stay with us, Cyril Whittaker and Don Trask.
The only doctor that I can remember that used to do the call, so we had a Dr. Brown in Havelock. He was a fine Englishman, and he did the calls. And the only other one I remember is Dr. Cashmore. But he used to do a call to my parents' place. Often the call stayed pretty late.
Oh, no, yeah. Did the same at my parents' place. My first call was out to the country, and I got to this house. They said someone's dying. Got to this house, and there were cars everywhere, people everywhere. So I finally stepped over people and got to the room where this patient was. It was a pretty old, I would say half married, but he had pneumonia. So I gave him some penicillin, which was the correct treatment. And then they said, well, come and have a cup of tea after I'd seen him. And I was told that you never refuse a cup of tea. That's not respectful. So I go in there, and there's a big table in this area, and people are having cups of tea. And no one ever mentioned any payment. So I was aware of that. So, and it was about 10 miles out, at about midnight on a Sunday night. So I saw off the kitchen a big pig hanging down. This is for the tangi. And I said, oh, that's a big pig. Looks nice. And they said, oh, would you like some? I said, oh, yes, thank you. How many children you got? We only had one. I said, well, two. One was on the way. So be four of us. So I got some pork to take home. That was the payment. But, you know, people like Roe Cashmore, for instance, when I was working with him, if you were in bed in a cold house with, say, pneumonia or bronchitis, he would not send a bill. He'd probably deliver a bag of coal and a couple of blankets from home. No payment. And that's how I grew up. And I found it very difficult to charge people, even in Hastings sometimes, if they didn't have much. I'd say to the girls, well, she needs some money more than I do, so don't charge her. They said, you're silly. I said, oh. But that was just the way I was trained. Yeah. And I got my reward in the gratitude and the thanks.
Yes, you're probably a bit kind to some of them, but they never do you any harm.
If you can afford to do it.
Yeah.
I can recall in Hastings, I used to go and see a patient and his wife most weeks, and she was my mother's bridesmaid, so I could not charge her. But every time I went there, she'd say, I've got something for you. And I'd say, oh, what is it? It'd be a cake or some biscuits or just something, which she'd done herself. And it was a bit of a joke with us. I went there one day, and she's offered something for you. I said, what is it? She says, money. And I said, I don't need your money. But she was upset. She says, this is a gift of love. And she'd been left some money from an aunt, and she was giving me a third for her husband and a third for me. And so I bought a horse for the farm and named it after her, Rose. But you know, those are the things that you
remember too.
Yeah. But you know, to me, the money wasn't, I didn't want her to go without. But she said, this is a gift of love. It's only a short person. She got quite angry, but didn't last long.
Well, now what about, when did your grandfather first come to Hawke's Bay, or your great-grandfather?
That I don't quite know. Well, all I know is when my father was just a 7 or 8 year old, he used to take him down to the St. Andrew's Church, then back to the Pacific. In fact, when they lived at Hamilwana, they used to have a horse and dray. This horse and dray would take my great-grandfather to the Clive pub and bring him home. No driver at all.
Mr. Starnes was the same at the Havelock Hotel.
Yeah. But they've been good days. I've been lucky, much luckier than a lot of my contemporaries. I used to look after a lot of my ex-schoolmates. It's pretty hard to be unemotional when you're looking after somebody who's dying, you've known since you were at high school.
Tell me about the family life, you and your wife and kids. They were all in Hastings.
Well,
what do they do while you were doctoring?
You mean my wife?
Yes.
Well, Judy was just, she was a receptionist at home. She filled all the phone calls. She was a nurse, or had been a nurse.
Yes.
But no, she just raised the family, as most people did in those days.
And you had four boys?
No, three boys and a girl. In fact, my sisters had the same, three boys and a girl. Interesting.
Right. What about sport and other skills and talents? Were you a member of any clubs or?
Or Rotary Club. Well, I'm a charter member of Stortford Lions Rotary Club. I was the rugby doctor, you know, for Hawke's Bay. And of course, I played golf.
And a very good golfer, I might add, too.
I remember Barry Lavery beating me for the BMA Cup because Ted Shilton said to me, well, we're on the fourth tee, we said, don't go out of bounds. what do I do? Yeah, it'll be us. And that cost me, I lost the cup by one stroke. But we used to have a lot of fun. We used to be Peter Dennehy, myself, Trevor Wrights, and, you know, 12 of us. Rex Bennett, Alex Spears, yeah. But gradually they just disappeared and died.
You didn't have any war service?
Yes, I did. If you count the Otago Medical Corps, we were at medical school. If we joined the territorials, we got full kit of clothing, boots and stuff, and great coats, and we got paid £1 a day to go out there on a day's. We got fed, and we used to go to camps in central Otago. I can recall going to a field day, and some of us were like doctors or first aiders, and some were patients. And so the patients had a little label on them to say what was wrong, like broken leg or head injury. And we had this field day and got back to Dunedin, and we were one short to the head count. And the guy who had concussion, he thought he should not. Most of the guys said, I'm over here. So you know, it made it easy. This guy with the head injury thought, well, he's not allowed, he can't talk, he's concussed. So he stayed there. And it got dark. And so I was in the territorial. And we used to have at Boys High, we had cadets there. Do you recall people like Bruce Comrie? Well, he and a couple of others, I don't know who it was, they got suspended for firing a live Bren gun into the big gum tree, which they were well away from it. Where the bullets went to, I don't know. But
what are the notable things you did in Rotary?
I was the third president of the club. I held every office but secretary. It was Max Grainer's job.
And are you a Paul Harris fellow after all that?
Yes, I'm Paul Harris.
So you held that back from me?
Oh, well, I'm Paul Harris twice. I've got a special, well, there's a sapphire up in the thing. I'm a double Paul Harris, and the only charter member.
What about your travels that you've done now overseas?
Well, there's two parts to that story. Yes. Judy and I, she had a sister over in Washington, D.C. So we went across there. We went to see my sister in Vancouver. So we went that way, mostly. And we went to Hong Kong and Singapore to meet some family coming home each time they were overseas. Been to Australia a few times. But basically, we had the farm and as a recreation, and that's what we did. Now, after Judy died...
And what year was that?
2007. Gordon and I were... We didn't socialise all the time, but we just...
You were great friends.
Yeah. And strangely enough, well, after Judy died, Gordon and I seemed to get together more often. And they were here one day at the table for lunch. And on the Monday, Gordon rang me and said, basically talking about Russell's health, about whether he should have an operation. So we were discussing family, because they were patients of mine, although Nolene wasn't, but Gordon and family were. So, you know, the plan was that he'd ring me back on Thursday and would sort of finalise what we should do. And the phone went, and the voice said, "That you, Bruce?" I said, "Yes." It was Gordon's voice, but it was Russell speaking to say that Gordon had dropped dead in the village. So then I went to the funeral. I said my words at the funeral service. But we had a plan that he died on either the 5th or 7th of June, a year later, after Judy died. And we were due to have a memorial service here for Judy's first anniversary. And of course, Nolan rang up and said, "Well, I really can't come because of Gordon's death." So I said, "Well, I understood that." And I said, "Well, come and have a cup of coffee sometime." So rang up and arranged for Nolan to come and have a cup of coffee. And then she was going up to Auckland to see her daughter and family. And we arranged to go. I said, well, when you get back, give me a ring. We'll go out and have lunch somewhere, just in a very supportive way. I was trying to support her at the stage, emotionally, and we just sort of gradually enjoyed each other's company.
Yep.
And so Nolly and I have travelled the world. We've been everywhere. Well, first of all, she said to me one night at a restaurant at Elephant Hill, well, I think I'd like to go to the Mediterranean because I've never been there. She said, I've booked my ticket. She said, would you like to come? I said, yes. So that's how we started off. Went there, we did East and West Mediterranean. In fact, we were on the Concordia just before it sank. We went to London, then to Europe, then back to London. That was our first trip. Then we went from San Francisco to Miami through the canal. Then we flew to Bangkok, went from Bangkok to Dubai. Then we went from Peru to New York through the canal again, and from Boston to Montreal. And the last big trip was going from Shanghai to Sydney. We went to China. That was 5 weeks, but too long. But we went to the Great Wall. So it was on the Great Wall, the pyramids, Niagara Falls, and those are three of the great ones.
The Hanging Gardens, Egypt, or somewhere.
Hanging Gardens in New York, where they used to have the old railway line. And we'd be going to Hawaii every year. But it's a long way, and so we think we'd just do a few short. We go to Australia every year, and we go to Lake Eads and Taupo every year, about 6 weeks. But we'll do Samoa in July, and we'll pick up Rarotonga next year. And it's just, we enjoy it, but the ship life is, 5 weeks is a bit repetitive. But, you know, we've enjoyed it.
Well, that's pretty interesting life. If you do happen to think of anything else at a later time, just let me know and we can come up and we can put it on a second.
Well, all these photographs. One photograph I can recall was, they used to have a street parade. Every firm put in a float. And we used to, because Thomas Ritchie used to make a lot of windmills, they did everything, metalwork. They make anything with copper or iron. And I can see this photograph with my Aunt Lena on the float with a windmill, not a full size, but half size or quarter size, and with a sign which says, you never miss the water until the well runs dry, which is quite true. In those days, every firm in town put a float on. Coming back to the earthquake, a lot of people ran out of roaches and got killed, and a lot of people stayed inside and got killed, but others survived. The roaches had lost a lot of customers and staff.
They're the ones on the corner of
the... Where the farmers are.
And the area up the top, that round bit, is that still there?
Yes.
What was in there?
It's just a feature. It may be a bit of an office.
Well, on behalf of the Hawke's Bay Knowledge Bank, Bruce, thank you very much for that, the story of your life.
You're most welcome.
Anyway, thank you very much.